Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the JMD Podcast Record Club, where each week one of us picks a record for everyone to listen to, and then we review it. And this week, we're going to be talking about my recommended record. We're going to be talking about progressive rock legends, Rush. We're going to be talking about their 2002 album, Vapor Trails. First of all, we've had this channel for more than 3 years and have not formally talked about Rush in any capacity. I've mentioned them on some of the segments we've done this year, like now segments wise, but we haven't dedicated a full review to any of their albums, which is a crime that I needed to rectify. But which one? Rush have a litany of classic albums. We are all three of us huge Rush fans, and we'll even go to the bat for some of the more controversial releases that the band have had in the past. So it opened an interesting window for me to be like, why don't I talk about something that's a little bit less discussed, a little bit less in the popular canon, and maybe give some shine to an album I think is particularly underrated. And I don't have, like, I'm spoiled for choice in terms of underrated Rush albums, but the one I wanted to zero in on for the longest time is probably what I would consider the most underrated Rush album. And that's for a plethora of reasons, but it is Vapor Trails. Vapor Trails comes at the turn of the century, basically. So this is, you know, Rush are a little bit past their imperial era here, but for the longest time, they sort of moved into this 80s synth place where they kind of lost some of their classic rock, you know, fans as they went on after albums like Signals and what have you. And after all that, they kind of come full circle and they started around in the 90s to kind of return to some of their older sound. Albums like Counterparts, for instance, that's an album that's sort of in this era that's kind of similarly constructed. But this album in particular, I wanted to talk about because it's very contextually important to the band and specifically one member of that band. And because the initial reception to this was kind of, I guess, clouded by the fact that the mixing on the original version on this album is borderline fucking unlistenable. We're specifically reviewing the remixed version of Vapor Trails, which is the definitive version of the album, which changes the unfortunate fate of the original, which was Loudness Ward into Oblivion. And this is a 66 minute long album, so listening to that is a great way to give yourself a horrible fucking headache. But now we have the definitive version of this album. And in terms of what this means for Rush as a band, it has a little bit to do with one Mr. Neil Peart, and comes off of the back of two particularly horrible tragedies that involved the death of his daughter, which tragically happened in, I believe, a car accident when she was on her first day of college. Like, she was on her way to university, and then that was where she died. And the death of Neil's wife. So this is an album that was written, I don't know if it's in tandem with the novel Ghost Rider. I'm not sure which came first, actually. But basically, Neil has an entire book called Ghost Rider, which is one of the songs on here that deals with what he did in the wake of these tragedies, where he essentially got on a motorcycle and just basically went on this huge cross-country road trip of just, you know, trying to find himself. Yeah, self-discovery and like grieving and just trying to deal and reckon with everything that had happened to him. And I mean, that's fucking horrible. And then after that, he goes and he basically writes the music for Vapor Trails. And a lot of the music on here directly interrogates ideas of grief, ideas of loss, ideas of perseverance, travel, being in transit, all that kind of stuff. But other than that contextual information, I think what makes Vapor Trails special is that this is an album where they just go back to basics. It's a classic progressive rock album. It sounds extraordinary, but it relies on the muscularity of the band more than anything has in like the past 20 years that they had made at this point. So it's a really good album to zero in on because it embodies all of the strengths that a band like Rush can have, but it's also very easy and very emotional. It's just a great all-rounder record that while I wouldn't quite put it on the like Permanent Waves, Moving Pictures, Grace Under Pressure tier, I still think this is a comfortable top of the A-tier Rush record.
So having acknowledged the tragedy that informed, well, I think it was more that informed the break that the band took in the late 90s, essentially.
That as well, yeah.
It was a soft breakup almost. It was like Neil basically said, you know, I'm done. making records, and he needed to go through that process of grieving and that process of having that time to himself and of having that experience of traveling across the country and writing Ghost Rider, which came out the same year as this album. So I believe they probably were ways of getting back into producing art and expressing himself that Neil was doing in tandem. But a big part, I think, of the narrative of this album, apart from that, is also the narrative of Rush as a musical unit and of Neil Peart, Geddy Lee, and Alex Lifeson finding each other again, finding how to have the sorts of chemistry that allowed them to make their greatest records. And that's not to say that they had been in a particularly fraught period in terms of their relationship with each other in the 90s. I don't really know all that much about that level of it, so I couldn't speak to that. But certainly I would say that 90s Rush, or really beginning with Presto in 89, is somewhat of a creatively, let's just say, fraught era of the band, where they had throughout the 80s basically perfected what their sound was, you know, continued to reach outward and really have a fantastic formula for what the Rush album could be. Usually somewhere between 8 to 10 songs, between 40 and 50 minutes, and just really hammering on that technical power that they have as performers and that emotional level that Neil can bring with his writing and that Geddy can bring with his performances. And that was something that they had nailed that so good by the time of like Moving Pictures that they were able to coast on that for several records throughout the 80s. And essentially, you know, it's not that their 80s records from, you know, Signals to Hold Your Fire are the same necessarily. It's just that they found a really good formula and that they were able to explore that in, you know, one way or another. But ultimately, it was one Rush album after another Rush album. You know, and
they use the same toolkit.
And after a while, you know, that's the creative itch, you know, increasingly pushes you to explore and expand. And the way that the kind of music that Rush was making was sort of falling out of fashion throughout the 80s as well. There was increasingly less and less cultural place for Rush as the 80s went on. So you did see them not trend hopping necessarily, but sort of experimenting, I would say, a little bit more in the 90s, and particularly with records like Roll the Bones, for instance. And, you know, they had that one too with Rupert Hine with as the producer with Presto and Roll the Bones. And those were, you know, records that, well, they're not great, but they are records that show Rush trying a few new things and sort of trying to feel out what their direction's going to be. And then you had Counterparts, which I think is pretty handily the best 90s Rush album. But
oh yeah,
honestly, kind of because it's a bit of a backward step to what had been previously successful. And then Test for Echo is, I think the general consensus, I think, is that this tends to be regarded as the weakest Rush album. You know, it's not necessarily
better Presto
thinks that, but it's the most sort of, I would say, lifeless Rush album. You know, it doesn't have some of the misfires of records like Presto and Roll the Bones, but it's kind of their Around the Sun in terms of REM, or their New York City Ghosts and Flowers in terms of Sonic Youth. It's that kind of record where it's sort of like, you know, people are not generally all that fond of it. And maybe that sets it up for a reevaluation, but it's not a record I hold in particularly high esteem. And then, of course, you had the events that you've described and that time away that was necessary for Neil to heal. And I think also, again, in some degree, for the band to find a reason to keep going. And that's something where it feels like the weight of being in a band for that long must really catch up with you. And this is an important thing to say as well for any legacy band like this. It's not about how good you are or about how good you are at making records or whatever. Time catches up with you. And it gets harder to do that again and again and again. It gets harder, and it can feel increasingly more and more pointless, the idea of making new records once you have, like, you know, this was their 17th album. And, you know, the joy of touring for a lot of these legacy bands becomes the biggest driver. And so the idea of making new records starts to feel a little bit incidental to that, or maybe a means to that more so than a necessary drive that they have. But I don't think that Rush have ever really phoned it in fully. You know, maybe maybe Tess Ferrico could be a little bit perfunctory, but you know, it's still Rush. They're still putting their best foot forward. You know, there's still good performances on that record, and it's still, you know, three of the greatest rock, you know, one of the greatest band dynamics in rock history, always consistently there. But, you know, in reading about the background to Vapor Trails and about the journey that these three men went on together in creating this album really increased my appreciation for what a breath of fresh air this is. For starters, this is the Rush album that took the longest to make. Now, this record was in gestation for, I can't remember off the top of my head now, I don't know if either of you know, but it was like several months, I think, it took them to make this. Maybe even closer to a year, even.
I was going to say, I think it is a year.
Yeah, it took them, you know, up to a year, if not more, to make this album. It was just really slow progress. And
according to Rate Your Music, which is usually pretty reliable for these things, it was January from November of 2001.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
basically
11 months.
Yeah, basically that year. And a lot of that time, you know, based on what I've read about what the band have said about that experience, was not even just writing music, but just kind of getting their dynamic back in place. You know what I mean? You know, these men, obviously with a really strong bond and friendship, rediscovering and reevaluating why they want to make music together and what the drive is there and the chemistry that's necessary for Rush to make records. Because obviously every band, every great band needs to have this kind of interlocking chemistry, but it's especially like, it's so pivotal to Rush, because it's not just that these are three men doing three things that a rock band needs. It's this, they meld, you know, Neil writes and Geddy sings, and there is a symbiosis there between those two. You cannot have one man without the other. And of course, Alex,
it's about communication.
Alex is like the glue that ties all of that together, right? Like Alex is, you know, in many ways, one of the most, you know, immediate and flashy aspects of what Rush do. And so the thing that makes Rush one of the all-time great bands, and I think a contender for one of the greatest bands of all time, is that there's no one standout, you know, the guy. You cannot have Rush without these three men. You know, it's just each, and, you know, they all bring something so essential to what they do. And you feel that chemistry sliding back into place when you listen to this. I do think it has to be really impressed what a difference the remix makes. And certainly a lot of albums around the late 90s, early 2000s, Metallica, have struggled a little bit with the loudness wars situation and with trying to find a sound that resonates in an era where, you know,
Ricky Rubin,
in an era where, you know, popular rock is in its grimiest and ugliest sounding place. I don't say that as a derogatory thing, but that's just, you know what I mean, you know, it's a new middle era. How does a smooth, professional, you know, polished rock band fit into that landscape? So a lot of bands, like legacy bands, struggled around this time to kind of figure out the sound they wanted. And so I think it really is a testament to the power of that remix, how much more alive Vapor Trails feels in that remixed form. And it has
The only version you can get on streaming. So
yeah,
I'm not surprised. I certainly didn't struggle to find it.
Yeah.
So yeah, obviously the band have fully endorsed it. And so it's important to acknowledge, because, you know, to some degree, the issue with loudness and the issues with brickwalling is, I imagine, must have been a hurdle for some people with the album and upon its initial release, even though that was a fairly common trend around that time. The biggest issue with the loudness wars thing is not just that the original Vapor Trails is as brick walled as it is, because there's plenty of albums that are like that, you know, heavy rock records that are like that, that you can kind of, if you get into that mindset, it works. It's just that Rush are a band when you think of Rush, you think of the polish, you think of the pop, you think of the slickness, you think of everything being so machine oiled, right? But of course, having that human component. It's like Rush are a band that sound like machines and the precision of their playing, but are also unmistakably so human in their expression. It's a weird thing with Rush that makes them so, I think, enduring and appealing. As you're listening to three men achieve perfection in a way that feels as though it's so, it can't really be possible for humans to do sometimes. So that's important. I think that's that, all of that story and understanding the dynamic of Rush and understanding why the band works in the first place is key to getting into Vapor Trails, I think. And yeah, Neil's writing with this record does obviously show off the journey that he's been through. It's not explicitly a record about grieving. It's a record about healing. It's a record about healing yourself. And it's a record about having the energy to wake up every day, basically. And it's obviously so informed by that cross-country experience that he went through. Morgan, I haven't really heard from you at this point, and I can kind of consider you the biggest Rush acolyte of the three of us. Where does this record
you've
sit?
You've got the shirt.
Where does this record sit in the canon for you, and what's your relationship with it like?
As far as the Rush canon goes, this is... it's between this and Clockwork Angels for that number five spot in the top five. It is interesting the way that, From Presto onwards sort of played out for Rush. Because really, I don't even think Rush really have any bad songs, even. There are some choices that were made, but usually I still find myself enjoying...
The Roll the Bones, the title track, good-ass song. I will make no apologies.
Like, it's fun. Even the rap verse is fun. It's just entertaining. No matter what they're doing, they're hitting a baseline of entertaining. Yeah. And that holds true to all of their albums to some degree. I think Test for Echo is my least favorite for the reason that it just excites me the least. Even though it also has some highlights, like the title track. Every Rush album, without fail, has an absolutely show-stopping song on it. But it's interesting where Vapor Trails comes from, because it even more than a sort of, back to basics record like Counterparts, I think Vapor Trails has this element of fully hitting the reset button and learning the dynamic of this band to each other all over again. And that really comes through in the music, because I think for the first time, I mean, probably since Hold Your Fire, the band really sounds like they're sure of themselves. I think this is the first time since Power Windows that they really fully just put their foot forward into something, and it completely pays off. Back when I was finally crossing off, every Rush album, listening to each one of them, I was putting together a Best of Rush playlist, which is just the best songs from every album into one giant playlist, and it ends up being like 8 hours long. It has like 72 of the 120 or so songs that they put out in their career. To reflect that, I think like 8 of the 12 songs from this album are in that playlist. It's interesting. The length of the record is maybe the only thing that holds it back from like the S tier for me. I think this is something that sort of plagues a lot of the CD era Rush albums. So much of the strength of their best records comes from the fact that, yes, they have these giant sweeping suites on them, but they usually tops out at about 40 or 45 minutes. And it's when things become a little less filtered in the CD era that their albums just kind of don't pace as well as they used to. And that's even a problem that this album runs into, as great as it is that it just ever so slightly outstays its welcome.
I'm not quite drinking the Kool-Aid as fully as you two are, but, and I say that because I do have issues with the length of this record, but I will say it's a weird thing where it's like the chemistry is so beautiful across this album. And I really emphasize that word because I think this is the most beautiful Rush album. It is the Rush album that for me has the most moments of arresting beauty, and not in the sense that you might associate with that word of prettiness or whatever, but just in the sense that the chemistry that these men have and the inescapable weight of the context that brought them to this point adds a dimension to their playing for me, and it's just a part of how I experience it. It's out of my control, and it's out of their control to some degree as well. It's just a context that I have that makes it feel like a true communion listening to the men on this record play. And it's certainly a thing that stands out if you go through Rush's discography in chronological order, because I would say it's stronger. It's just more a part of this than maybe any record they had made since, I honestly don't know, Grace Under Pressure, maybe. It's not to say there aren't great records between that and this. It's just that there's a quality to the sense with which this needs to exist for these three men that makes it enhanced. That said, my issues with length are less to do with there being songs, specific songs on here that I wish had been cut, and more to do with the fact that no matter how great you are as a performer, it can get fatiguing listening to you after a certain amount of time. And that's just something that I experienced with this record, partly exacerbated by the fact that I think they perfected their record structure so beautifully throughout the 80s that hearing them be a little bit more digressive and a little bit more kind of inclusive of, you know, just the wider package of songs that have come out of these sessions feels like they let go of some of the magic that comes from those records for me. And also a part of it is Neil's writing obviously this record has some of his most poignant writing. I mean, songs like One Little Victory and Ghost Rider in particular are just very powerful songs. But, you know, it being a record where the lyrics are written by Neil Peart, you also get plenty of, this isn't a bad thing. It's just a Neil Peart thing. In songs like Peaceable Kingdom, where it's like, the lyrics are like talking about sharing a rational view, justice against the hanged man, knights of wands against the hour, swords against the kingdom, time against the tower. It's all very like fantastical and kind of
orc shit.
Well, it's dork shit. Yeah, and it is like, it's a bit, this is the thing, I suppose, when you analyze on a certain level, you kind of take away from the magic, because on paper a lot of it's kind of just, I don't know, it's just ridiculous. But again, the magic comes out of how Geddy Lee sells it.
Oh, fuck, is Rush.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was like, this is the band.
Exactly. But I will say that Geddy Lee, as great as a performer as he is, I struggle to listen to him for more than an hour at a time. There's just something about his voice that's not a negative. It's just, I get the most out of this.
Skillish.
A little bit, you know, when it's a little bit more... I don't know, look, I just get to a certain point in this record with songs like Sweet Miracle and Freeze, where it's we're kind of, okay, I feel like I'm making this out to be a bigger deal than it is, but it's just fatiguing is the only thing I have with this record. That said, I'll take a step back from that critique to admire the ways in which the record does demonstrate diversity as it goes on. To an extent, you know, with context, it's still very uniform and, you know, very Rush doing Rush for song after song after song, but there's a little bit more of, there's some subtle ways that the record experiments. You know, Sweet Miracle has this kind of like almost sort of funky aspect to the rhythm section that completely, like the guitar, like what Alex is doing is not funk inflected at all, but there's this kind of bounce to the rhythm section, and then Alex is doing his blinding, you know, rays of guitar that he's so great at, and then Geddy's doing like a, there's a slightly kind of new agey atmosphere to what Geddy's bringing. It's a weird combination of things that doesn't quite fully congeal for me, but I appreciate the way that it stands out. Nocturne as well has a little bit more dynamics in it, a little bit more kind of quiet loud in it that makes it feel a little bit of a like a breathe out moment, because the record can be maximalist to a fault. You know, it can be a lot of Rush being amazing to the point where it's like, you know, you start to get sunblind a little bit. So yeah, I think in that sense, the record is really at its strongest in its first half. Vapor Trail, I actually quite like Earthshine though in the back half, I think really, really still.
Yeah.
I find that song to be really pretty and really arresting musically. Although I do, you know, I run out of ways to distinguish the parts of this record that I enjoy after a while. It's just a great Rush album where I am most excited and animated by these aspects of chemistry and these aspects of emotional potency that comes through from the context. I was like in my bathroom this morning listening to One Little Victory and brushing my teeth and just fucking dancing. And that was,
that as you do,
one of my enduring Rush memories going forward in my life, was in my bathroom brushing my teeth and busting a move to One Little Victory. I don't have much more to say about it, frankly. It's a revitalization that Rush needed, although there's something kind of ironic to the fact that it's a revitalization that then took another decade after it was created to be revitalized. There's something so labored about this album in every way. I don't mean that in a bad sense. Like, it took a year to make, and then when it was made, it was sounded wrong, and then it took 10 years to be corrected. And now it's just this, like, it's this product of toil, right? It's this product of struggle and suffering and like combative effort to get to this point. And so marveling upon it, it's like, you know, appreciating that pain and toil and effort that went to getting it to this point that it's at. So yeah, in that sense, it's a kind of awesome album that I think you appreciate that awesomeness more if you come to it later in your Rush experience. I wouldn't necessarily recommend this to someone who's not that familiar with the band.
No.
But yeah, it's a beautiful album.
I like the idea that it's a product of strife. That's kind of why I don't necessarily mind that I think that the back half is a little bit weaker. And again, it's really only marginal to the degree to which I think that, is that this is an album that feels like it is actively fighting to be heard by someone. And I feel like in the narrative of it, like, you know, the remix, the fact that it took a long time, that just adds to its appeal. And the fact that it lasts as long as it does, it's like, it's always satisfying to me. A lot of the album's greatest moments, like not even just like moments in terms of singular songs, but moments in terms of just these songs devolving and digressing into passages that are gorgeous to behold, they're staggered throughout the record pretty evenly, even though I would say that most of my favorite singular moments are still probably in that front half. Again, like, I think Ghost Rider is one of the best Rush songs, one of the most definitive Rush songs to me. It's one of the most powerful and emotional, and not even necessarily in the way that it's like dour or anything. Like, like Riley said, this isn't an album about grieving. It's an album about healing. And that's what Ghost Rider is to me. It's an album, or it's a song that is about searching to find yourself. And same thing goes with songs like The Stars Look Down, which this album just has so many great underrated top tier Rush songs that I just feel like have these moments of pure elated beauty. And that synergy that they have is key to their success. But at the same time, it feels like this is still an album where I can zero in on everything and find it to be just individually so impressive, mainly with Peart's fills on here, which, I mean, maybe the definitive showcase for Neil Peart as the definitive rock band drummer, like the greatest, like GOAT status shit. And I think that, like, again, the front half of this record, stuff like Ceiling Unlimited, for example, I mean, like, these fills, these are fucking enormous. Like, part of the reason why the original version of this album must have sucked is because you can't fully appreciate the depth of the sound here. So much of this is like Porcupine Tree Blackest Eyes levels of just absolutely fucking enormous impact that you're just like, holy shit, these guys have got it.
I did go back and dip into the original as a reference point, and I'll say that that's certainly one way in which the record, I say the biggest way in which the record suffered in its original form was just that Alex is doing is the most impacted, mm-hmm. I think, by the brick walling. And I suppose Geddy's bass playing as well, but that's, you know, that's almost easy to take for granted. But Alex's guitar parts in this record are so, like, such a heavy and a key part of the mix of the album and the remix, and so much of the intricacy of them, especially in songs like Peaceable Kingdom, where he has some really intricate guitar parts, I think are lost in that original format. There's one other aspect of the record that sort of stands out in terms of Rush's catalog that I think that's worth acknowledging, is that there are no synthesizers on this album. It is a guitar, bass, drums, vocals, stripped back record in that respect. And you know, it's kind of easy to miss that because of how maximalist mm-hmm. the compositions are, how kind of in your face the album is. It does not feel as though it's missing that aspect initially, anyway. Like after a while, once you get to know the record, and or if you go back and listen to, you know, Grace Under Pressure or whatever, then you notice the difference. But it's meaningful that the band chose to minimize the different components of this record to really kind of hone in on something, I guess, more primal to them, more direct in their expression. I think that's another aspect of the album that gives it weight and power, is just how simple it is in terms of a component setup, but how vast it is in terms of the scope of this, like, and just in terms of how huge it all sounds and how rich everything is.
Pretty decent record, you know. It's pretty all right.
Just three of the greatest musicians of all time to play their respective instruments, just, you know, fucking about, what have you.
Yeah, it's a real, you know, it's a really unique moment for so many reasons. You know, the absence of synthesizers, the background story, the context, the fact that it was the album that saved the band in a certain sense, you know, that there was the reason and the function for them to get to this place. You know, I think about it, I'm going to propose a dynamic here, like a narrative dynamic for us to kind of consider this. And I want to talk about it in relation to Metallica's Saint Anger. And the reason I say that is that these records were recorded around the same time. And they're like, they're both less about the albums themselves and more about how they, the process of making them, you know, and I'm thinking more about, I guess I'm talking about this more in relation to Some Kind of Monster than Saint Anger, the album itself. But like, these two legacy rock bands who had these kind of high pinnacles, you know, slightly different eras of high pinnacle, but you know, they were both huge in the 80s, have going through this kind of process of existential crisis as a band, you know, like, how do we move forward? How do we, you know, find the spark again? And, you know, thinking about how the fraught nature of what Metallica went through to try and find that spark, and how, you know, lifeless that the product of that ended up being, versus the, you have to imagine, similarly difficult and labored process that Rush went through, and then this being the result, but only, again, like, in a way that was hard to appreciate for a while until the album's full, you know, majesty could be appreciated with the remix. It would still be a record with a lot of issues, but it makes you wonder a little bit about what a Saint Anger that's been vapor trailized might be like to experience.
I wonder if you could even do that to that album.
It's so intrinsic to their respective identities as bands that it's very telling that when they were in similar places as people and as bands, you know, being fraught like they were, that Rush doubled down to make this very like stripped back, plainly sort of beautiful record that's inflected with a lot of kind of vastness, I guess, and scope. And then Metallica kind of like, they throw the baby out with the bathwater and just kind of like, they shove in a bunch of shit. They do a bunch of new shit they've never done before. They overthink everything. It's just that's the key difference, is that to me, this isn't disparaging when I say this, but it's like, to me, Vapor Trails is an album that feels effortless. It feels like these three musicians are just like, the music just kind of pours out of them naturally. Whereas with Metallica, that is an with Saint Anger, it's like, that's an album where its key problem is that everyone is trying way too fucking hard.
Well, yeah, that's true. I regret bringing up this comparison because they're records with very different philosophies. Like, Rush are never...
They are, yeah.
Rush would never make a record that has the kind of emotional tone of Saint Anger, because Rush are about, you know, life and vibrancy and
unity,
the power of the world and like the natural energies in the soil, man, and the sun shit. And
Rush is a band about the dirt.
And Metallica, with that record, where, you know, the whole point of its identity was, you know, depression and darkness and sadness and lingering in that. So yeah, very different albums. I just found the timelines and the stories behind them and the issues with production to be interesting parallels.
You just can't. There's no way to make that snare sound good.
Yeah.
That's true. Just rotten to the core. You'd have to re-record the whole album.
This album, on the other hand, that snare.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
oh. Yeah. Neil, God, drummer. I also feel like, to some degree, the conversation around this band musically focuses a little too much on him, but I get it. You know, he is.
Yeah.
Alex Lifeson is the greatest living guitarist, and I guess the most underrated aspect of Rush is probably Geddy, is that like he kind of gets a little bit of shit for his singing voice being an acquired taste, even though I think he's an incredibly skilled vocalist. Like, yeah, he's kind of a like love him or hate him kind of thing, but I still think he's great and he's really talented and dexterous. But like his bass playing, oh.
Well, in a lot of respects, Geddy is the most impressive member of the band because he's the polymath, right? He's the singer, he's the
yeah.
and he plays the synthesizer. You know, those are three very
the glue
things that involve very different skill sets. And the fact that he's able to, mm-hmm. you know, that the stuff he does, the way he plays the bass and the way he plays the synthesizer, admittedly not on this record, but typically the way he does that is never perfunctory. He's always like going... Mm-mm. Out there and the synth lines that he writes and the bass parts that he does and in the way he delivers Neil's lyrics, it's, you know, Geddy deserves maybe more flowers than he gets indeed because of how much he does for the band on different levels. Yeah, anyway, we could this is a real like some real like guys being dude shit here, just talking about, you know, the most impressive member of Rush. We could go on and on like this. I feel like I should have a beer in my hand while we're having this conversation.
We're out on the fence and King of the Hill.
Yeah, for real. Just feels like, yeah. Well, I tell you part, what, man. Earth Shines a really damn good song.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what about that new part, man. You hit the snare down, get the hi-hat, and he goes, shoo.
I was saying, any three male or male-presenting podcasters, there's like a... You know, inevitably, inescapably, will at some point be talking about Rush in that context. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if your podcast is even about music. At some point, any three dudes with a podcast will be raving about esteemed kit work of Neil Peart, you know, the blinding, blazing, bright guitar tones of Alex Lifeson, and the incredible polymath skill of Geddy Lee. It's simple. It's a fact. Let us know at home what you think of Vapor Trails by Rush. Where do you feel that it fits in the canon? What's your relationship with the record like? Is there anyone out there who would ride for the original mix as well? I just feel like I have to ask that because we've just kind of operated from an assumption that that has no merit, but maybe there's someone out there who prefers the album that version. Whatever your thoughts are on this record, let us know in the comments below as well. Let us know if you want to hear us talk about Rush some more as well. Like I said, it's a miracle that we've taken this long to do this. I was even saying to Morgan last night, I was like, you know, kind of just flirting with the idea of like, maybe we should do a Rush retrospective. And I said that in hushed tones because it would take like 2 years to do at the rate we do things. But anyway, if you want more
Never
Rush,
stopped us before.
If you want to go above and beyond and support us directly for just $1 a month, you can become a member of the Jams and Tea family. Your name and the title call of everybody on this channel. Plus, if you want to recommend us music to talk about in our Jams and Tea Now videos, your recommendation will go to the top of the pile. Until next time, though, folks, rock over London, rock on Chicago. United Airlines, fly the friendly skies.